Now, we're going to try to do, this is going to have to take us, to get through this chapter, we're going to do about an average of 7 or 8 verses a day. So that means you have to read that much. So by tomorrow, you should have really be reading ahead and at least be up through, you know, text 15 or something like that, because I'm going to go through the first 6 or 7 texts of this chapter, I hope, today. Because there are 40 verses in this chapter, and there's 6 teaching days left. So that means about 7 texts or 8 texts a day we want to get through. But some places we're going to go faster, and some places we're going to go slower. So if you can just try to get ahead and stay ahead. So just by way of review, who knows the difference between Shruti and Smriti? Don't all speak up at once. Yeah, poor cell. This looks like a vital
distinction. Shruti is the part of the Vedas that Vyas divided before. Smriti is the Mahabharata and other Puranas. And he wrote this like additional.
Yeah, so say it like this. Shruti is the original Vedas. Right, the original 4 Vedas, up to and including the Upanishads. And then the Smriti, you can just call it Vedic supplements. Remember, the Vedic literature, this is the basis on which we take our stand. And we should know very well. I mean, this is ultimately, there are different means of knowledge. 3 basic means of knowledge. The one that really counts is scriptural testimony, pramana, as the Vedas. The other means of knowledge are sense perception, and the other one is reason or inference. These are the 3 fundamental ways you know something: by sense perception, pratyahara; by inference or reason, anumana; and by Vedic testimony, pramana. Is that right? Pramana is Vedic testimony. Did I get them backwards? Yeah, shabda pramana. Yeah. Pratyahara. Pratyaksha. Well, pratyaksha is one way. It means sense perception. It means, anyway, the 3 modes of knowledge, of which sense perception is unreliable. And so basically the fundamental mode of knowledge is scriptural evidence, shabda, sound, transcendental sound, shabda, pramana, and reason and argument based on. If your logic and inference is correctly done, you follow the rules of logic, and it's based on evidence from Shastra, then that's also valid. However, sense perception is unreliable. So therefore, everything really comes down to Shabda. If there's a contradiction between what our senses tell us and what Shabda says, or Scripture says, we are supposed to accept what Scripture says, because it is produced by someone who has not the defects that we have, our limited senses, our tendency to make mistakes, our tendency to fall under illusion, and our propensity to cheat. Yeah.
Would the inference be speculation?
No, if you have inference. Now, there's 2 kinds of inference. Correct inference is not speculation. If you have a deductive form of argument, then there's nothing in the conclusion that's not in the premises. In other words, if I give you 2 premises, all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, then I drop out the deduction, therefore Socrates is mortal. That's not speculation. Because Socrates is mortal is contained in the 2 premises, and you're just making clear what's implied by these premises. So that if the premises are false, then that's something else again. But the argument form is valid. So if it's deductive argument forms, then it's not speculation. What speculation is, maybe your premise is based on speculation, like sense perception. How do you know I'm an immortal? Yeah, well, because either we have testimony from Shastra or we really don't know. And maybe I'm different. Huh? Yeah, sure. That's why they need them to fight wars. Anybody over 30 knows better. It's true. Anyway, so there's essential distinction, Shruti and Smriti. Yeah. Vedanta is really its own category. Huh? It's also a kind of Vedic supplement. I wanted to discuss Vedanta. Because usually the Smriti includes the Itihasas and Puranas. So another thing that Vyasadeva composed is the Vedanta Sutra. Now, we discussed in the original Vedas, the final concluding portion is called the Upanishads. And so the topics that are discussed in the Upanishads, or the study of the topics discussed in the Upanishads, goes by this name, Vedanta, which is a combination of Veda plus Anta. This A is long. When the two A's come together, it becomes a long A. Vedanta. Veda means knowledge or the Vedic literature, and Anta means end. Now, the way Prabhupada tends to take this is Veda means knowledge and Anta means end in the sense of final goal. When actually Prabhupada came to Temple University to a Hinduism class this semester before I took that class, and they were studying Hinduism, and Prabhupada asked the class, "What is the meaning? You're studying Vedanta." It was being taught by the head of the Ramakrishna Mission. "You're studying Vedanta. What does it mean?" And nobody knew. So Prabhupada said, "Veda means knowledge, and Anta means end." So the end of knowledge is Krishna. So you can take it as meaning that philosophy which is concerned with the final end of all knowledge, which is Krishna or the absolute truth. Many people take it, Anta, to mean the Vedas and then the concluding part of the Vedas, which is the Upanishads. That's another way people commonly take it. Because it deals with the philosophy of the Upanishads. In the Upanishads, various sages and rishis discuss the absolute truth, and their discussions are recorded in the Upanishads. So that is Vedanta. Now, what Vyasadeva did was compile something called Vedanta Sutra. Sutra means it means a small, short, pithy utterance, an aphorism. Sometimes they're described as aphorisms. And Vedanta Sutra is a organized list or organized structure of little aphorisms. It's divided into different parts and subparts. It has a structure. And the aphorisms are condensed. Every single extra syllable is driven out until you get things boiled down to where they're really terse, so that in fact you can't understand them unless you have a commentary to expand them. They're condensed. Highly condensed. Now, the reason this is so, as far as I can understand it, is just so you can memorize them all. You'll find, like, example, the rules of grammar are also in the form of sutras. So you can, there's 4,000 rules of grammar, you can memorize them. Little school children sit and chant the sutras for Panini's grammar. You know, from the age, when they start at the age of 5. And then when they're a few years older, when they start to learn what they mean, they've got the whole grammar in their heads. But they just sing it. It's unintelligible to them. But they memorize them. So similarly, Vedanta Sutra, the whole systematic study of Vedanta, of the meaning of different verses and the settling of controversial meanings of verses, is all in the Vedanta Sutra. And in these aphorisms. Different sages compiled sutras of Vedanta, but the definitive one is given by Vyasadeva. And when Krishna says, Vedavit Vedantakrit Evachaham, 15:15, Vedantakrit, I made the Vedanta. Vedavit, I know the Vedas. Vedantakrit, I made the Vedanta. I compiled the Vedanta. So this is the Vedanta Sutra is also a composition by Vyasadeva. Now there's a history to this word Vedanta because there turned out to be different schools of Vedanta. One school wanted to interpret the sutras with the idea that the ultimate truth was impersonal, that the final word and the ultimate truth was impersonal. In the Upanishads, you see the absolute truth is referred to some places as a person, some places as something impersonal. How do you fit all these together and reconcile them and come together with an intelligible structure? Well, one way is Shankaracharya's famous commentary on the Vedanta Sutra called Shariraka Bhasya. Bhasya means commentary. And in which he expounds the impersonal or Mayavadi philosophy through his commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. Later on, the great Vaishnava Acharyas like Madhva and Ramanuja, they also wrote commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra from a personalistic point of view, that the absolute truth is ultimately a person and that the impersonal aspect is a subordinate feature. And that way, so you have these different schools of Vedanta. Well, what's happened is right now, it's at least in the West, when people talk about Vedanta, they usually mean the impersonal school. But actually, Vaishnava Vedanta is also there, and that's gradually becoming recognized. But for a long time, the Mayavadi propaganda was so thoroughgoing that everybody thought that Mayavadi philosophy and Vedanta philosophy were one and the same thing. So Vedanta is really the understanding of the absolute truth, the science of the absolute truth. They're put together in this code. So the Vedanta Sutra was made by Vyasadeva. And it's quite a study. It's a study of the Vedanta Sutra. And you can spend many lifetimes... and people do spend many lifetimes involved in this study. So is that clear? That's another. When in Vedanta, when it's listed, what are the evidences for our statements? When we give philosophical statements, what are the evidences? They call it prasthana. Prasthana Prasthana means like foundation, the three foundations, huh? And they're Shruti Prasthana, Smitri, Prasthana, and Nyaya Prasthana. Nyaya is a word, it's usually translated as logic. But it just means kind of systematic discourse. Nyaya Prasthana means the codes of Vedanta Sutra. So that in Vedanta philosophy, there's three sources of evidence. The Shruti, the Smriti, and the codes of Vedanta Sutra, which are called Nyaya Prasthana. Huh? Oh, yes, excuse me. Yeah, N-Y-A-Y-A, Nyaya, Nyaya, sorry. Uh-huh. Okay. Now, so this was another compilation. This will also come up in this chapter, this Vedanta Sutra. Because after having done all this, written down the Smriti, written down the Shruti, composed the Smriti, composed the Nyaya, the Vedanta Sutra, still Vyasadeva is unsatisfied. So let's start looking at this chapter now here. And what we see is in the first text, you'll notice it's a very nice thing to see the Sanskrit. Prabhupada gives us three chances to understand the words of a text. You should notice this. There's the word for word translation, there's the running translation, and there's the purport. And sometimes you'll see that a word in the text gets translated or explained in three different ways. One way in the word for word, another way in the running translation, and another way in the purport. That's really important because there's a lot of meaning packed up into these texts, these verses, and Prabhupada uses this structure to bring it out. So it's always good to look. And if you look at the Sanskrit, you see this very in Sanskrit it's very clear: Devarshi, Praha, Viprashim. Devarshi and Viprashi are the two rishis. The rishi among the devas and the rishi among the vipras are meeting. So we know this is a high level engagement. And you see, that meaning becomes clear in the word for word, but it's a little obscured in the running translation. Devarshi, the great rishi among the gods, said Viprashim to the rishi among the brahmanas. So the rishi among the gods is speaking to the rishis among the brahmanas, like that. So it's just nice how it's there in the Sanskrit, and you can pick up on it. So we see from the last thing that he's disappointed and upset. And so now the two of them, he sits, Narada Muni sits on the Vyasasana, and now he's going to give him some instruction. Do you have something to... The Vedanta Sutra is the... Vedanta Sutra is the way in which the Vedanta philosophy is expressed or codified. And if you have a Vedanta philosophy, you present it in the form of a commentary on the sutras. You're not considered to be a legitimate transcendental school or Vedantic school unless you have a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. Well, that's why the Gaudiya Vaishnavas did not have their own commentary until fairly late, because it is considered, this is the special place of Srimad Bhagavatam, which we'll get to, it's considered to be Vyasadeva's own commentary. It is, in effect, a commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. Because, and this is indicated by the first verse, Janmadhyasya Yatondhyaditratash, it begins with the same the beginning of Vedanta Sutra, the second sutra, is Janmadasa Yataha. It defines the absolute truth as that from which everything emanates. See, very, very briefly, Janma Dasya Yataha. That's the sutra. And to understand it, you have to add water and let it expand because it's so dehydrated. Janma, it means literally Janma, birth, etc., that which, or you know, from which, you have to say, from which, birth, etc., from which. Which means, being expanded, that from which, it's defining Brahman, because the first sutra mentions Brahman. Atato Brahma Jignasa. Now, therefore, there should be inquiry into Brahman. Next sutra, Janmadasi Yataha. That from which, birth, etc. So, being expanded, Brahman is that from which proceeds the birth or creation, etc. means maintenance and destruction of what? Of everything that there is. So that's how it's defined. So it's very succinct, and you have to expand it. And that's what you do in your commentary. So the second verse, the first verse of Bhagavatam begins, Janmadasya Yataha. It defines Krishna as Janmadasya Yataha. Therefore, it's regarded as Vyasadeva's own commentary on Vedanta Sutra by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Although it's not written in the form of a formal commentary on the sutras, it is in fact implicitly explaining the purport of Vedanta. Okay? So, they sit down together. I'm just going to go through now here and point a few things out. He's despondent, disappointed. And that means there's something wrong, because if you're situated nicely in spiritual consciousness, you should not be despondent, disappointed, distressed, upset, and so on. You're supposed to be happy all the time, right? Addressing Vyasadeva, so it says, Narada Uvacha. Now, first Narada speaks. So they sit down, Narada speaks. He says, and he identifies him as Parasharya Mahabhaga. Parasharya, the son of Parashara Muni. He says, you are the son of Parashara Muni. Yeah. Are you satisfied by identifying with the body or the mind as objects of self-realization? In other words, why are you in Maya? Huh? He's asking this. This is a hint. Prabhupada says, this is a hint. That there's something wrong. First of all, why should somebody like you, who has a father like Parashara Muni, be despondent? It can only be because somehow or other you have settled for identifying the body or the mind as the self. Because that's the only reason you can become unhappy. Once you've identified the self with the body or the mind, then there's a chance for misery to come in. But if you're actually situated in your self-realization, he says, one cannot be cheerful by nature unless one is factually seated in self-realization. What he says here. So how is it possible? You're the son of Parashara Muni. So he says right off the bat, he sits down, and without beating around the bush, he lays it into him. And he says, he goes on, your inquiries were full. This is an interesting, jignasitam. See, I mentioned earlier that the beginning, this is a little hint, the beginning, first sutra of the Brahma Sutra, atato brahma jignasa. Now, therefore, inquiry into Brahman. Brahma Jignasa. So this verse has the same. Jignasitam. So this is a reference to this nature of Vyasadeva as the expert knower of Brahman. Your inquiries were full. Your Brahma Jignasa. And your studies were also well fulfilled. And there is no doubt you have prepared a great and wonderful work, the Mahabharata, which is full of all kinds of Vedic sequences, elaborately explained. So here he makes reference particularly by name to the Mahabharata. You've done a great job. It's a fact. You've prepared the Mahabharata, which he calls here Sarva Artha, including all sequences. Paribrahmitam, elaborately explained. Artha simply can also mean purport or meaning. Sarva Artha, with all the purports. So he fully inquired about Vedic knowledge, as a result of which the Mahabharata is compiled with full explanation of the Vedas. So here he mentions, this Itihasa, the Mahabharata. Next verse, Jignasitam Maritam. Again, the same verse. It begins, you should notice these things, which you won't pick up in the English, but you'll pick it up if you look at the Sanskrit. Again, Jignasitam, begin the same word again. And again, you have deliberated full well about Brahman. The subject of, here Prabhupada says, impersonal Brahman, as well as the knowledge derived therefrom. And here Prabhupada says, here it describes the Vedanta Sutra. So notice in these two verses, the two major works are specifically mentioned by Vyasadeva, the Mahabharata and the Brahma Sutra. And so I want to introduce here a theme that will run through this about these two divisions of the Vedas, which we're going to call karma, khanda, and jnana. Khanda means section. About the diacritics. There's two visions, the karma khanda and the jnana khanda, sections of the Vedas. As we'll see later on, this mention of these two things, particularly the first division of the Vedas, karma khanda, deals with the actions and reactions of material nature, with fruitive work. Specifically with elevation for the higher planets. And the Jnana Khanda deals with inquiry to the absolute truth with the aim of achieving liberation from material existence. Usually, inquiries into the absolute truth with the aim of achieving liberation from material existence. The Jnana Khanda section of the Vedas culminates in impersonal Brahman realization. And this is basically what, up until now, Vyasadeva had mostly transmitted. One of the most fascinating things about this chapter is the way it criticizes the Vedic literature. I mean, it really trashes the Vedic literature. There's a famous verse about the literature of the crows. It talks about the literature of the swans and the literature of the crows. And of course, in the purport, Prabhupada talks about modern fiction and everything like that. In the context of the chapter, it refers to all the Vedic literature that isn't dealing with Krishna. That's what he's talking about, including the Mahabharata. That's in the Bhagavad Gita also. Sure. It is in the Bhagavad Gita also. And one of the things that I want us to learn from this class is how to understand. This particular pastime is very tricky because Vyasadeva sits down and he transmits all the Vedic literature. Then Narada Muni comes in and says, you made a big mistake. You should have left out all this stuff and just dealt with Krishna consciousness. So you say, fine, that's great. But then you have to think, well, you know, wait a minute. Vyasadeva is, an incarnation of Krishna. He's transmitting all this stuff. It's not really that he made a mistake. So Krishna really must have wanted all this stuff transmitted. And then at the same time, Krishna arranged to come and put it down after doing that. What's going on here? And what's going on here is you just have to understand something about, I guess we call it Vedic thinking. And to describe it in a nutshell, and this is why you need to have spiritual master, is it's not simply enough to have a database or to know verses. Because anybody can find verses, especially in the Vedas. There's verses for everything. But you have to know the purpose of the Vedas. You have to know what they're for. You have to understand in a contextual situation what the verses mean. Because the Vedas are designed for all kinds of people, to promote them upwards. There's three sections. There's Karma Kanda, then Jnana Kanda, and then the last section is called Upasana Kanda. Which refers to Upasana means worship. Worship of the Supreme Lord. Sometimes the demigods are included in this section. And this is one is teaching karma, one is teaching Ganda, and this Jnana, this is teaching bhakti. Upasana means worship. It means coming close by to worship. Upasana Kanda. And what we see is ultimately this last part of the Vedas, which is actually teaching bhakti, is actually the highest teaching of the Vedas, but is also so confidential that it's not manifest fully until Vyasadeva expels it out in Srimad Bhagavatam. But I just want to explain to you just to give you an idea about what's going on. Let's take this sequence, right? Good, better, best. And over here is bad. And we could say worse and worser. Right? So say you want to take somebody and push them along in this direction. So there's somebody who's on the platform of bad. Bad means, in this case, he's a vikarmi. He gratifies his senses and breaks all the rules and regulations. Right? He engages in sex indiscriminately with all kinds of people. So we want to make him good. Right? So we preach to him the glories of married life, the wonders of household life, the beauty of being moral and up, you know. So we gradually preach a certain way to get him from bad to good. Right? So now he's really attached on the good platform. But we want to get him from good to better and then to best. So now to get him to go from good to better, we have to say, you know, householder life is the pits. You know, materially material attached householders and so on. So you have to turn around and say something that you are glorifying to get him to go from bad to good. Not to get him to go from good to better and from better to best. You have to turn around and then talk about it in a different way. and so on up the line. So that's why you see in the Vedas you can find all kinds of verses glorifying the worship of the demigods. Say, that's good. Or putting down the worship of demigods and extolling impersonal Brahman. And then putting down impersonal Brahman and extolling Krishna consciousness. And so, because, you know, good may be better than bad. But good is the enemy of better, and better is the enemy of the best. So it's to move people up. So you have to speak different ways to people on different platforms. So the whole thing is somewhat contextual by nature. And we get very confused in our movement sometimes. Because, and I really hate these debates that sometimes go on, where, you know, one group has their quotes and the other group has their quotes, and they throw their quotes at each other like thunderbolts, and nobody listens to what's happening or what's going on. So, you know, you have the, you know, people with the householder life is good quotes, and the people with the householder life is bad quotes, or different topics like that. But but part of the thing is that Prabhupada's teachings is contextual. What are we trying to do? Where are we trying to get people? And people will be situated. So we have to be understand that there's a certain amount of suppleness or flexibility in the Vedic teachings. So there may be things that look like contradictions, but that contradictory nature disappears when you see what the whole picture is. And the general framework is like this. So this is why you'll see in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, you know, right away puts those who are attached to the flowery language of the Vedas and so on, putting down the karmakanda section of the Vedas. Well, why should he put down the karmakanda section of the Vedas? Who produced them? Who brought them forth? Who established them on earth? Krishna did. Well, why should he now turn around and criticize them? Well, because now it's time to come off of that platform. It's better to go to the heavenly planets than it is to go down to hell. But if you're attached to the heavenly planets, well, you're just going to rotate in birth and death, and so now you have to, and so on. Yeah. I have to tell you something that I don't know. Because I'm not Vyasadeva, and I'm not Narada Muni. And somehow or other, that's what was done. And it wasn't my plan, it's Krishna's plan. And so I can only tell you what they did. And that's what they did. And we also... So you may say that there was it was no use in putting out the karma kanda, jnana kanda section of the Vedas. Certainly, that's what we learn from Srimad Bhagavatam. We're followers of Srimad Bhagavatam, so we know for us, at any rate, that we should not get involved with it. But why he did it anyway, that I don't know. There could be various reasons. We'll see later. You know, we'll see what... The hard words that Narada Muni has, you know, you've just, what he says to him is, you've encouraged sense gratification in the name of religion, and you're contaminated people with pantheism. That's what he says, karmakanda and jnanakanda. Pantheism and sense gratification. That's what you've done. There may be some need for it still. I don't know. Yeah.
Perhaps you can do some parallel in history
with
Buddhism.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get to that.
There's different
missions.
That's
right. Well, Buddha is later. There was a Vedic restoration to recover from Buddha, because later on, we'll get to this later. We'll discuss Buddha comes up in a purport and... As an example of Narada Muni is actually thinking about what Buddha will do. when the allowance is there for meat eating. He says, you've allowed restricted sense gratification, but everyone will just forget your restrictions and take the sense gratification. And that's precisely what happened. And also to emphasize the importance of Srimad Bhagavatam. I assume that Narada Muni and everybody knew this was coming, Vyasadeva also. So this is all part of the preparation for Lord Chaitanya's movement. But the question is, that he's asking, is why not just skip everything else? And, what can I say? I once asked Prabhupada a question like that. If Krishna runs the whole universe, the super soul, why does he need demigods? And Prabhupada said to me, you don't know how to run a universe. And I had to admit that was true.
Poor Sam. Srimad Bhagavatam is meant for the people of Kali Yuga, which are basically the karmic people. Mm-hmm. Why is it teaching the highest thing? Why doesn't it teach us gradual development?
Yeah, that's what we'll see. We'll get into that. That question will be answered later on. Yeah. I can't teach the whole course in one class. I want to get on to some more verses. Yeah? Pete, did you have your hand up? Yeah. Yeah. But then that's contradicted right in this chapter. In this very chapter, Krishna contradicts, Narada Muni contradicts that. He said, if you perform your own duty perfectly, what good is it? But if you give it up and take up the Krishna consciousness and you blow it, still you're better off. That's what he says in this chapter. And Prabhupada refers to that text in the Bhagavad Gita and said, that doesn't always apply. So pick your verses, Okay, let's go on here. I want to keep on going. I just wanted to bring this out. So here we notice in text 3 and 4, there's a reference to the Mahabharata and to the Vedanta Sutra, which, as we'll see as the chapter develops, really refers to this whole Karmakanda and Gyanakanda section of the Vedas. He said, you've done these two things, and still, why are you feeling dissatisfied? So that's Narada Muni's question. Having done all this, why could you possibly feel dissatisfied? So then in 5, Vyasa replies. He answers him. He says, all you have said about me is perfectly correct. That is, I've done all these things. Despite all this, I am not pacified. I therefore question you about the root cause of my dissatisfaction. Huh? He says here, he calls it in Sanskrit, mulam avyaktam. Mulam means root, and avyakta means undetected or undisclosed or unmanifest. Somewhere deep down, buried inside, there's some cause of that I am upset, and would you kindly tell me what it is? Because I can't figure it out. That's what he's saying. I therefore ask you about the root cause of my dissatisfaction, for you are a man of unlimited knowledge due to your being the offspring of one who is self-born, that is to say, Lord Brahma, who has no mundane father and mother. So he said, then Prabhupada points out, all knowledge disseminated in this material world is related either with the body or the mind. And that is the root cause of all despondencies. And he's suggesting that in the Karmakanda, Gyanakanda stage, this is contaminated with gross bodily ideas, and Gyanakarma is contaminated with mental identification. Including attachment to the modes of goodness here. He said, this is not always detected. So then he says, my Lord, everything that is mysterious is known to you. because he's addressing here. Because you worship, he's talking about Narada Muni, because you worship the creator and destroyer of the material world and the maintainer of the spiritual world, the original personality of Godhead, who is transcendental to three modes of material nature. So because you are the worshiper of him, Gunai Asanga, who is unattached to the modes of material nature, therefore you can tell me these things. It says, a person who is 100% engaged in the service of the Lord is the emblem of all knowledge. So he becomes perfect, not by his own qualification here, but by qualification of the personality of Godhead. And then he describes further Narada Muni. Like the sun, your goodness can travel everywhere in the three worlds. He compares them here to three elements, or to two elements. The sun, who can travel everywhere in the three worlds, or the sunlight goes everywhere. And like the air, so like light and like air, you can penetrate into the internal regions of everyone. You see everything from the outside, from the inside. As such, you are as good as the all-pervasive Supersoul. Please, therefore, find out the deficiency in me, despite my being absorbed in transcendence under disciplinary regulations and vows. So he says here, now I have to get some help from a higher authority. I myself, he says, as far as I know, I'm doing everything right. Sometimes we find we're in that kind of a situation. We seem to be doing everything right, and still something is wrong. Well, where do we go? So here's the answer. Someone who's a representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and can give us more insight into our condition than we ourselves may be able to possess. So that's his question. So Narada says here, Narada answers him, gives him his diagnosis here. Text 8 and 9. He says, you have not actually broadcast the sublime and spotless glories of the personality of Godhead. That philosophy which does not satisfy the transcendental senses of the Lord is considered worthless. Although, great sage, you have very broadly described the four principles beginning with religious performances, you have not described the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So here, he uses the word in text 8, darshanam. Darshanam means philosophy. And so here, he only takes it up so far as the Brahman realization, maybe Paramatman realization, Prabhupada says in the purport. But he does not go all the way. And Prabhupada says here, the compiler of the Vedanta Darshan. See, that's that word Darshan is in the text. So Prabhupada says that refers to Vedanta Darshan. I said Darshan means philosophy. The compiler of the Vedanta Darshan is Vyasadeva himself. Yet he is troubled, although he is the author. So what sort of transcendental bliss can be derived by the readings, readers and listeners of Vedanta, which is not explained directly by Vyasadeva, the author? Herein arises the necessity of explaining Vedanta Sutra in the form of Srimad Bhagavatam by the self-same author. Now, you've given the Vedanta, but from the Vedanta you cannot explicitly derive the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You're going to have to give your own commentary. That's what he's saying. Although, great sage, you have very broadly described the four principles beginning with religious performances. You know this sequence, right? Dharma. These are the four sequences beginning with dharma. Dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Does anybody know the Sanskrit name for these? Purusharthas. Purusha arthas means the four aims of life, I guess. Artha, ends of life. Goals of life. Goal, thank you. And the sequence goes like this. Dharma. One before, this is what's in the Vedas, the four things taught by the Vedas. One, dharma means religious performances or pious activities or activities regulated by the Vedas. That's dharma in one sense of the word. Activities related for the Vedas. Why do you perform them? Artha. Prabhupada translates that here as economic development. I mean, the word artha means all kinds of things, including purport, as we've already seen, sarvartha. But here it means something of value or meaning. So here it just means money, economic development. Why do people want economic development? Kama, for the gratification of their senses. So the Vedas are teaching dharma, regulated fruitive activities for the sake of economic prosperity so that all our necessities of life can be satisfied. Then finally, moksha, liberation. When you get disgusted with kama, then you turn to liberation from the material world, and that's also there. So this is generally given as the four artha, purusharthas in the Vedas. Now Lord Chaitanya says there's a fifth, which is what? Prema. Yeah. Prema pumarto mahan. Prema pumarto. Pumarto means same thing as purushartha. Prema pumarto mahan. Prema is the great fifth goal for or aim for humanity. So he says, you've explained these four things, beginning with religious performance. Now here it's interesting to see, now Prabhupada says this, the prompt diagnosis of Sri Narada, as it once declared. The root cause, remember, mula avyaktam, has been uncovered here, was his deliberate avoidance of glorifying the Lord in his various editions of the Puranas. We discussed yesterday, he had composed 18 Puranas. 18 Puranas. Six in the mode of ignorance, six in the mode of passion, six in the mode of goodness. They're usually described like that. And he deliberately avoided explaining the glories of the Lord. Here Prabhupada said it was deliberate. We have to put, you know, Narada Muni considers it a miscalculation. He had certainly, as a matter of course, given descriptions of the glories of the Lord, but not as many as given to religiosity, economic development, sense gratification, and salvation. So certainly in those Puranas, as in the Bhagavad Gita part of the Mahabharata, Krishna is described and the Lord is glorified. But he's saying it wasn't sufficient in comparison with the given to, I mean, the Mahabharata, I forgot how many verses long it is. It's huge. Huh? 100,000 verses. And Bhagavad Gita is how many? 700. You know? So it's a disproportionate amount of words spent on things other than glorification of Krishna. Yeah, yeah.
They try to find some fault, but here there's no need for fault.
Yeah, it's explained, right.
Further
elaboration. Narada Muni has already found the fault, huh? He goes on. These four items are by far inferior to engagement in the devotional service of the Lord. Sri Vyasadeva, as the authorized scholar, knew very well this difference. So not saying he wasn't that he was ignorant. He knew what he was doing. Huh?
You said the golden age started in reference with Vivekananda.
No, but Vyasadeva knows the golden age of Lord Chaitanya's coming. You know, maybe he had to do something before Lord Chaitanya appeared. You mean, or Lord Krishna? Or Krishna already appeared, so there was a little gap. I don't know how to run Kali Yuga either, let alone create a universe. And still, instead of giving more importance to the better type of engagement, namely devotional service to the Lord, he had more or less improperly used his valuable time. And thus he was despondent. From this it is clearly indicated that no one can be pleased substantially without being engaged in the devotional service of the Lord. So anyway, there's more. You have to should go through and read these all for yourself. But that's basically, that's as far as we'll go today up to that. We'll start tomorrow in the class with text number 10. So Narada recommends to Vyasa that he should now eagerly and repeatedly describe the path of devotional service. This would cure him from gross despondency. And now tomorrow we'll pick up the two kinds of birds.